So this is audio part two for Thomas versus Primus. And now we're going to take a look at easement by implication in action, or easement by necessity, or the easement by necessity flavor of easement by implication. We'll talk about this again. The reason I keep bringing this up is that if you start taking a look at kind of third study party guides, or you go into your particular state, you might find out that particular state calls an easement by necessity, not a type of easement by implication. Don't want anybody going out there saying, yeah, but Professor Katropia said virtually in 2020, right? Always check your local listings. And the hope is that we're giving you a taste of what there is possibly out there. So here we have in Thomas versus Primus, we've got a single lot. It's shown there, lot A, we'll call it, owned by Martha Thomas. It turns out that Martha uses a little roadway, to get from the street that is in the front of her property into her property, right? It turns out it's just like a little driveway to her house that's there, to that public road. And all other parts of her property, we'll call it Lot A right now, are bounded by private property, right? So the only way to kind of get to the public road is to interface on that side of A as it goes to the public road that's there. Then if you go to slide 7, we find out the other transactions that take place. Turns out that Martha decides to convey part of her property to Arthur Primus. Essentially, she kind of splits it in half and conveys the property to Arthur. And there's at least some discussion that there's an oral agreement that Arthur, who has now Lot B, got an oral agreement to actually use the passway, or essentially that little walkway or driveway, to get across Lot A, to eventually make his way up to a lot B. But we don't have a writing here. If we had a writing, we could easily create an easement by writing. We'd be in good shape. The problem is we don't have a writing. We then start to have a series of transactions. Essentially, the defendant to the case, Primus's brother, ends up taking possession of lot B. And then many, many, many years later, the grandchildren of Martha end up taking possession of Lot A. And so now we have Lot B owned by Primus, Lot A still owned by A. Thomas, and we've got this essentially right-of-way, this little roadway that attaches the public road that makes its way all the way up to Lot B. If you go to slide 8, you can take a look at the top view. If you look at the very bottom, you'll see 460 Camp Street. That's the address of the lot at issue. And you'll see how it gets very deep if you go deeper into the lot. So obviously my little rectangular drawings don't exactly represent what's going on. But you can see there's the house. My gut is that was Martha's initial house. And then there's this lot that sits up behind it. If you go to slide 9, you get a front view of this. And so you can see that driveway that goes up. That's that little passageway that's there. And my understanding is if I keep going all the way up that driveway, I eventually get to that big clearing that's behind the house that's Lot B. There on slide 8. So if we go to slide 10, we see where all this starts going south, I guess for lack of a better term. So the grandchildren start to want to sell the property. So they decide they want to sell, but what do they put in their agreement? And the case doesn't go deeply in this, but we should because we've been talking about land transactions. It turns out that in the agreement, there's a general warranty of title. And if we know about a general warranty of title, and we've got what we're going to find out here is arguably a private encumbrance, this easement, affirmative easement, the mere existence of it by itself is a violation of the general warranty of title. But my gut here is Thomas would like to say explicitly, hey, you know what? I'm going to explicitly put in here that there is an encumbrance in existence. It's currently not being violated. You're good to go. The buyer, though, now learns about it. This is in some ways why we require either kind of an explicit agreement to say it's okay for us to have a private encumbrance, or if you don't specifically put it in the agreement that we've got a waiver, it's going to breach that general warranty of title and allows the buyer to walk away. The buyer now learns about it and says, oh, man, you know, when I looked at the actual document, it said nothing about this. Now you're saying that it's there. I don't want the property if it turns out that someone can drive across my property to get up there to lot B. And so Thomas says, okay, this is a problem. We've got a quiet title. And the reason we're going to try to quiet title is we want to basically get the court to agree that there is no right of way. And the reason we're going to say there is no right of way is because it's not in writing. I'm sorry. It's just not there. And that's the way you create an easement. The premise's response is, no, 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 no. There is an easement there. And I understand it's not in writing, so it doesn't meet the statute of frauds. But we have an easement by necessity. And so the court here goes through the requirements for an easement by necessity. And here the Connecticut Appellate Court says we first need a commonly owned piece of property. We need initial unity of ownership. If we go all the way back up to the slide to take an initial look, it looked like Martha Thomas owned it all, Lot A. Then we need a transaction that creates the necessity. Essentially, that transaction, when you break these things apart into two pieces or multiple pieces, we now have a necessity that necessitates the easement. Here, the Connecticut Appellate Court actually doesn't make that a requirement. A lot of jurisdictions require the necessity to be created when we have a transaction that breaks the property apart. Essentially, land locks in, let's say that's the necessity, in that particular property. Here, that's not required. If it was required, this would mean that Primus would actually have to be able to establish that all those other areas behind B were privately owned, and that when Martha sold Lot B to the brother, Arthur Primus, that created a necessity. The final requirement, the third requirement, is we need to have a reasonable necessity. It needs to be reasonably necessary for the use and enjoyment of the party's property. And so here, if we took a look at this easement, it would be an affirmative easement. It would be B being the dominant property, A being the servient property, and the idea is that B gets to do something across A's land, gets to walk across that little jaunt there, that little pathway to get to the public road. Here, all they require is a reasonable necessity. For use of Primus's property, I need to make my property be useful and to enjoy the use of my property, I need to be able to go across your property. Not all jurisdictions follow this reasonable necessity standard. A lot of them require strict or absolute necessity. We might actually have absolute necessity here, possibly, right? But the court actually only requires reasonable necessity, right? Which might be a little bit easier to establish in different cases that are here. And here, right, it looks like we probably do, right, have reasonable necessity just to be able to get across it and be able to say that we've got an easement by implication via this easement by necessity. And here we can say, okay, so the court said we needed common ownership. We didn't necessarily need a transaction that breaks it up that creates a necessity. And then we only need reasonable necessity. We can step back and say, well, is the court actually following what we consider to be the intent-based view of easement by necessity? Essentially saying that when that transaction took place, that when Martha broke apart her lot into A and B, did she intend, and essentially did Arthur and her both intend to create this easement? Or is this more a public policy-based one? The idea being of, you know what, we just think it is a net beneficial to provide B with this easement because they need the necessity. It's a little tough here to tell which way the court's following, mainly because they're using a little bit of both of the different standards. In one way, right, they're following a public policy approach because they don't require the necessity to be created at the time that the parcel was broken apart. A lot of times the intent-based ones require that because the theory is that that time of being broken apart, if there was such a necessity, that would push the parties to say, well, obviously we intended this to happen. But on the flip side, the courts that really follow a public policy-based version of necessity require a lot more necessity. Because if they're not going to imply it, they got to say, look, we've got to be really clear that here the benefit is much greater than the burden. That doesn't appear to be the case here in Connecticut either, because all they require is reasonable necessity. If we go to the next slide, slide 11, we can get a taste of, okay, well, what's the difference if we follow this by easement by implication as opposed to easement by necessity? There are some similarities. You need common ownership to start with. One of the big things with an easement by implication versus an easement by necessity is that we need a quasi-easement prior to breaking apart this unitary piece of land where we would say that an easement has been implied. What's a quasi-easement? The theory being is that one part of the land is getting the benefit of the use over another part of the land. And here the idea would be that B, part B, that top part of Lot A, was quasi-easementing or giving an affirmative easement where they were able to go across that bottom part of Lot A, across that walkway that was there. And how do we know whether we've got a quasi-easement? We would look to see the use right before we break up common ownership and say, look, is it obvious? that part of the land's being used for the benefit of the other part of the land? Was the use continuous? And was it permanent enough, right? Where essentially, once it's broken apart, the parties of the transaction probably would be implying that that easement would be created. And finally, with easement by implication, we don't require a ton of necessity, but we still require reasonable necessity. We can already see some of the similar requirements here with the easement by implication that we saw with the easement by necessity. And this is why a lot of jurisdictions fold these in together and either call them all under the umbrella of easement by implication and then say, okay, are we implying it from the transaction, from this quasi-easement, or are we implying it via necessity? One of the two. Would this easement by implication work in Thomas? Yeah, probably would, right? She was using it before. The use was continuous. We've got common ownership. It looks like the driveway was there. It was permanent. The court already found necessity. One thing that's interesting is that courts will vary how much necessity is needed depending on whether when you break it apart, the person who's selling off a piece is granting someone an easement or reserving an easement for themselves. If they're granting an easement, jurisdictions with easement by implication will only require reasonable necessity, which was actually what was happening here. When Martha broke off that slot, gave it to Arthur, she was granting Arthur an easement. Arthur was the one that gets to go across that that walkway that was there. If it had turned out it was the opposite, she was reserving the easement for herself, there are courts, a lot of times with easement implications, will increase the necessity that's required. And the reason they'll increase that necessity that's required is their view is that if the grantor is reserving something for herself, we really need to make sure that it's right that she should reserve it. And so we require a little more of that necessity in those regards. And so my hope here is you see this is very similar to an easement by necessity. Both of them require common ownership. Both of them require necessity, although a lot of jurisdictions require a lot more necessity. One of the big differences is an easement by necessity does not require this prior use, this quasi-easement before it. If you go to the next slide, here's a quick kind of hypothetical to take a look at to think about these things. In this case, this is the Van Sant versus Royster case. This lot 4 was owned by one individual. She had actually run a drainage line from her house all the way out to Highland Avenue where there was a common sewage line. She then ended up, if you go to the next slide, selling lot 19 to someone else. She actually sells it to Jones, who hooks up to that drainage line that's there. And if anything, if you look at this point in time, what's happening? Lot 4 has a right-of-way, here not for walking, but sending her sewage, across lot 19. We would hope that this right-of-way would have been in writing, an affirmative easement, with the benefit being for lot 4, the burden being on lot 19, probably appurtenant. It wasn't in writing. And so the question the court had here was, okay, do we imply an easement? And so the first thing, if we're looking at this with an easement by implication, we'd say, okay, did we start with common ownership? We did, if we go back up to the slide before. And then when we broke it apart, right, did we create some kind of at least reasonable necessity, right? Probably hooking up to county sewer is a reasonable necessity. And if we're doing an easement by implication, we'd have to say, okay, prior to breaking it up, do we have a usage that was a quasi-easement? Right part of lot 4 is getting the benefit of the use over the left part of lot 4. Is it obvious, right? Is it a continuous and is it permanent? Probably continuous, sending that sewage across. It's permanent. I dropped the line down there. The question becomes, is it obvious? That was actually one of the difficulties in this case. Would it have been obvious that you would have known that that line that you were hooking up onto of lot 19 was going all the way back to lot 4? You can see here, though, if a court doesn't grant an easement by implication, we've got problems. Because now how does lot 4 connect to the sewer line? To make things more difficult, if you go all the way to 14, what ends up happening is lot 20 gets split off from lot 4 as well and ends up also having essentially lot 4's affirmative easement going across lot 20. And so the way we do an easement by implication is we look for common ownership, this quasi-easement, something that was obvious, continuous and permanent, and some reasonable level of necessity. If we were doing this with just an easement by necessity, we would require common ownership. We then would require the breaking apart to create the necessity. And here, right, the argument, if you go between 12 and 13, that breaking apart is what's creating necessity. I've got to get across lot 19 if I'm lot 4. But then the real question becomes is, do we have something that's an absolute or strict necessity? If we were in the Connecticut court that just required reasonable necessity, I think we're in good shape here. If we're in Texas, let's say, where we require absolute necessity, probably not. Are there other options for lot four? Yes, there's a thing called a septic tank. There are other ways that I can take care of sewage on my property, right? In those cases, a court would probably say, you know what, we don't have enough for an easement by necessity.